Welcome to the Start, Scale, Succeed podcast with me, your host, Nicole Higgins, the buyer and retail coach, sharing tips, advice, and insight from entrepreneurs that have just launched to multi-million pound business owners. We will be discussing the challenges they faced, advice they would give, and the milestones they achieved and how they got there. Also joining me will be a broad range of experts with some tips and practical how-tos, episodes that will help your business grow and to enable you to live the life you crave. The types of experts that you'll hear from will be those that you will find beneficial as you start and scale your business, from branding and social media experts to mindset coaches in PR and marketing. There will also be solo episodes from me discussing a variety of topics from sourcing to maximizing the profit in your business. If you have a business, you may at varying stages be thinking about investment. My guest today is Luke Desmond, founder of Crisp Accountancy, to help you understand what you need to do, prepare for investment, and lots of different questions we're going to be covering in terms of the different types of investments, what you need for a pitch, and so much more. Luke, thank you very much for joining me today.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be on.
Now, I first saw you at Shah Wasman's Rise of the Female Entrepreneur, and what I liked about that whole event was demystifying investment and making it more simple and easy to understand. And that's one of the things you're going to help kind of strip away the jargon today, aren't you?
Yeah, hopefully. The investment world is this crazy, complicated world. Even for me as an accountant that knows numbers and business very well, when I first moved into investment-backed businesses, it was just mind-blowing. So I can only imagine what it's like to entrepreneurs that haven't experienced that, and particularly those that don't have a finance background. So I'm very, very simplistic in my approach. I'm a simple person, and hopefully try and, as you say, demystify and provide clarity for those that are going through that journey or thinking about going through that journey.
So Luke, tell me about what you do.
So you kind of introduced me, CEO and founder of Crisp Accountancy. We are growth accountants. We're on a mission to improve the financial education of small business owners, so all the stuff you just talked about there. And really, we're growth focused accountants, so we drive growth through financial clarity. So that's me and the business. We provide as much or as little support as everyone needs, full outsourced finance functions at the larger end. And then on an individual basis, and so me personally, I work as a fractional CFO with some clients, particularly around strategy, exiting businesses, buying business, and then relevant for today, which is raising investment.
And you work with a lot of e-commerce businesses as well, don't you?
Yeah, a lot of e-commerce and a lot of product-based businesses, yeah.
So let's start off then in terms of what are the different types of investors you can have? And if you're looking for investment at different stages, who do you need to be looking for?
Yeah, okay, great question. So I'm going to generalize a little bit, because as with all things, there's all kinds of investors don't always fit nicely into the little pots. But generally, you've got a few different categories. And I'll start sort of typically at the smaller end. So when businesses first start out, typically they're friends and family. So that is going to people they already know and say, look, I'm doing this thing. I need some money. We know each other. Will you invest? So kind of slightly more informal, slightly easier, but that's all about your own network. Like, not everyone has that luxury. Not everyone has friends and family that have 50K to invest, 20K to invest or whatever. But if you do and you can reach out to it, that's a fairly easy way to start in. Then you have the sort of angel investors or the high net worth individuals. So they're just, well, not just, but they're individuals that have got some money to invest. They can range from very sophisticated to not so sophisticated in the investment world. It might be their first investment. It might be their 100th. But typically, they make lots of small investments. And again, they typically go quite early stage. So they can be really useful if you're early stage or a bit smaller. And also, not always, but also they can come with more than just money. So sometimes it might be they come with experience, or they can open doors or give you some advice. They can almost form like that mentor role. Some are purely transactional, but that's quite a good way in. Then the sort of next level up is when you go sort of a bit more corporate. So typically you're then going to look at venture capitalists, so VCs. So they are investment businesses, a lot more formal, a lot more professional, if you like. They are risk takers. So they'll still invest in the early stage and the high risk stuff. High risk, high reward. And then at the biggest end, if you need sort of serious size investment, then you've got private equity is very corporate, pretty steady. So they still take risks, but a lot less risks than the other investors will take. But they only go after businesses of a certain size. So probably something like £1 million a year in profit is when private equity might come in. So you've got that sort of scale, that spectrum of different size investors for different stages of the journey.
And there's a lot of terminology and acronyms in the investment, what I've come across from the investment world. So
What would you class? So I've heard the word pre-seed. What would that be, and who? What would be the investors that you'd be looking at? Is that for those?
Yeah, like I said, you said at the beginning, and so I did try and eliminate all the jargon, but if you are going into this investment world, you do have to face facts that everyone you're going to talk to is going to use some of this. So it is useful to have an idea of this terminology. So pre-seed, seed, Series A, Series B, they are stages of investment in order of sort of small, early stage upwards, and loosely connected to the order in which I just talked about the investors at those stages. So pre-seed is typically very early on in the journey, a smaller amount. It might be before you're even revenue generating. So you've got an idea of a product that you want to develop, but it's going to take some money to get it off the ground. Then you might go in at pre-seed. You might raise £100,000, £200,000, that kind of sort of money. Friends and family, maybe a high net worth individual, just to get your idea off the ground. And the next level is sort of seed investment. And that can be anything from 500K to 1 million type investment. And that's where your business is up and running. You've got some momentum, but you're trying to prove product market fit and prove that there's really a high demand there. So that level of investment is to take you to that sort of next level. And then you have Series A, Series B, Series C, whatever. They're all the same thing, but for far more advanced businesses that have been there, proven they've got a product market fit, proven that someone's willing to buy it and they can make profit. And at that stage, it's all just about accelerating. So scale and growth, and those Series A will be probably pretty large figures to most of us as sort of 5 million plus investment rounds.
And so the difference between those Series A, Series B, is it generally just the amount of investment? So Series A would be looking to invest something between 5 to 10 million, Series B, 10
Yeah,
million, Series C.
literally. And you sort of just the order. Some businesses might be okay with one-off investment, and then sort of that's enough on their journey. And other businesses continuously need investment to take them on that journey. Typically, the really fast, really big scale-ups. So they'll raise a Series A, and then they'll know they need to raise more money and raise a Series B because they're growing in the right way, but they're growing so quickly they're still sort of hungry for cash. And then you might get all the way up to like a at the very largest end, maybe like a Series D or maybe even an E, and then that's when you sort of go and take the company public. Like that's kind of the scale on the spectrum. So that's miles down the line for most.
So don't worry. So if people are listening and like, I haven't even got my idea sorted out yet, don't worry about that. You think about like pre-seed and those
Pre-seed and seed,
angel
yeah. So,
investors, friends and family, up to that kind of 500K mark. And then when you're looking a bit more, it would be the seed and the angels and venture capital, which is probably where we're thinking about, the people that are listening here.
yeah,
And
exactly.
I've heard that, it can be varying in terms of how long that investment process can take. But before we go in terms of how long that process is, what are investors looking for?
So they're all looking for something different, depending on the size of investment you want to make and the stage of business you're at. So those types of investors and those stages of investment, so whether you're pre-seed or seed, angel or VC, those are all going to look for something different. But essentially, what they're all looking to do is to make money. And I know that sounds really simple and basic, but you can't forget that when you're pitching to an investor, they want to get a return on that investment. So you need to provide them with a story that is compelling enough that you are giving them enough confidence. The reward is big enough for the risk that they're going to take. So those are the fundamental concepts that you need to tell in your story, because raising investment is all about storytelling. And then, like I said, it will change depending on the size of investment and all the rest of it. But they're looking for a good idea, product market fit, and a way that you can scale and grow that and take it out to market.
And how can you, as someone who is preparing that pitch, then tell a good story?
Authenticity. I know everyone throws that phrase around, but it is really, really true. The investors want to see that you truly believe what you're selling and that you're passionate about it. Now, if you're selling a product, you can be passionate about the product, which is great. So, like, we've got some women's health product clients, and obviously they're super passionate about it. The story behind it is really compelling, and you just completely buy into it. And then there's people that sell products that maybe even they're not that infatuated with the product, because not everyone is. It depends on what type of product you're selling, but passionate about the business and the journey that you're going on. So passion doesn't have to be the end product, but passion about your business and commitment to your business is really, really, really important.
If you're looking for investment, what should you have ready? So, like, I know that you mentioned in terms of they're looking for the story, the product market fit. What are the kind of other things that you need to have ready? So we'll talk a little bit in terms of getting your pitch deck ready and preparing for that pitch, which I suppose some of this will cover. then as well. But getting yourself ready for investment, how do you do that?
Yeah. So before we touch on how you do it, you're right to bring it up because it is so, so important. And this is what you would have heard me talk about a lot, is that you have to be well prepared because the world of investment is cutthroat. And these people, well, not giving out the money, but making the investment, the people that hold the money that you want out of their pocket into your pocket, they'll have so many approaches from different businesses trying to get them to invest in this. So you need to stand out. And one of the ways to stand out is to prove that you are ready and prepared. Because on that question, two questions ago, the answer I gave was about confidence. So how can you get confidence from an investor? Well, you show that you're prepared and you're taking this seriously. So one of the things that will happen when you reach out to somebody is the pitch deck. So we'll talk about that in a minute. So you need to have a good, strong pitch deck ready. If they like the idea of the pitch deck, then one of the next steps is to get access to your data room. Now, your data room is literally just an online folder, a box folder, Dropbox folder, whatever, with the documents in it that the investor will want to see to explore the investment a bit further. So depending on the stage, that will vary, but it will be things like your financial model, your forecasts, your prior year accounts and tax returns, what the cap table is. So the cap table is just a list of the current shareholders, what shares they own, how many they own, percentage. So it's just you, if you're the only investor, easy. But if you've already raised investment, then you might have some friends and family on there. You might have like an angel investor on there. You might have given some shares to an advisor. So someone coming in, investors want to see who's already involved in the business. And then any sort of stats that are going to help with the data. So not so much for the very early stage, but if you're seed or series A type investment, let's say you're trying to raise £1 million and you're sort of £1 million or £2 million turnover, then they're going to want to see some of the data of what you've already done. So how much you spent on marketing, what return investment you've got for that. Client acquisition cost is something we'll probably touch on in a bit, which is data they want to see. So having that all prepared and someone going, right, give me access to your data and send me your forecast. And you go, here you go. It's already there. It's super impressive. Like instantly the investor's going to think, do you know what? They've got their stuff together. They know what they're talking about. My confidence has just been raised a notch already.
And where do you put in terms of, you know, what money you're asking and what you would do with that money? Or is that more for when you're pitching and you're having that conversation?
So you always want to put the amount of money you're asking for in the pitch deck. Definitely. Like you need to be completely upfront. There's absolutely no point in beating around the bush with this, with that bit. And then usually in the pitch deck, you will very briefly touch on what you're going to spend that money on. But actually at that stage, the investor isn't really too fussed about the detail, what you're going to spend the investment on. They're more bothered about the potential there and the journey that they can go on. Obviously, they will want to know what you're going to spend on in a bit more detail. So
this is like the first date.
Yeah,
like
exactly. Right, exactly. Yeah. You don't spill everything once and all on the first
date. You go, right, I want to get married in April. Then we're gonna have kids by September. I want to be pregnant. You know what I mean? It's the first date.
It's been a long time since I dated, a long, long time. I was 16, the last date I went on, when I wasn't married. So exactly that. I still remember, like, you have to hold something back. So enough to entice them in and excite them, but you hold it back. But you do need to know what you are going to spend that money on. So in your forecast, for example, like what you would show is you'd show perhaps a forecast of where you are at the moment and what the trajectory you're on. And then if you go and get investment here, what does that then do? Well, we'll raise £250,000. We'll spend £50,000 on product development, £50,000 on a new website, and £200,000 on marketing, Facebook ads, or whatever it is. And if we do that, this is what we then think the trajectory is going to look like. So you will have that information on the pitch deck. You're just going to say, right, we're looking for an investment of £250,000, for example.
Yeah. So investors are looking for, you've got your story, they're looking for authenticity in terms of being ready, having all that data together. I've heard about, and we know about kind of customer long-term value versus and the cost of acquisition. Explain a little bit about those and how to understand what your long-term value is of a customer.
Yeah. So again, risk of repeating yourself, it depends what stage you're at. If you're at very, very early stage, you're not going to have this data. But if you're more established, then you definitely should have this data. In the product world, it's really important. We're going to want to look at the lifetime value of a customer. And then we're going to look at the client acquisition cost, how much it costs to get that client and how much we make out of that client. So let's talk about the lifetime value first. So if that's all, we need to start by working out how much revenue or sales we're going to make from a customer. Because you're going to hope, as a product-based business, that you don't just sell once one single product. If you do, then your lifetime value is very easy to calculate. It's that one sale, but also it's very poor. What most product businesses are doing, and if you're not, you should definitely be doing, is using all kinds of tactics, email marketing particularly, for example, or other forms of marketing to re-engage their customers and get them coming back time and time again. So to calculate lifetime value, you're going to work out your average order value, so how much they're buying from you each time they buy. So the checkout, hopefully they're buying more than one product. Things like, as you go to checkout, them offering you a discount to boost another product on. And that's all about boosting your average order value. So that's how much they're buying at once. How often do they buy? So they might buy once a year from you. Or if you're a business like Amazon, if you buy from Amazon like I do, you might buy from Amazon like once every couple of days. So like Amazon got a really high return value. They might have a low average order value, but they get you coming back to buy more often. And then it's how long do they stay a client for? So how long is it that they're buying from you? Do they stay a client for a lifetime? Do they typically buy from you over a 6-month window and then they don't come back anymore? So when you multiply those together, you can work out on average how much revenue you're generating every time you acquire a new customer.
So say for example, you have a kids wear business and you sell products from age 0 to 5, and generally people may have 2 kids, 2.5 kids, or whatever it might be. And you would then hook, right, they're probably going to be buying from me, maybe hopefully every 3 months for the next 8 years, if they, or 10 years, if they have 2 kids.
Yeah.
If you know what I mean.
Perfect. So, and you can work out how much they're buying from you each time as well. So if you want to increase the lifetime revenue in that example, it's really good because you've got the 3 different variables. One of which you can't really change, which is how long they're going to buy from you, because you can't control how many kids they have. So the only way you could control that is by expanding your product range to go beyond 0 to 5. That may or may not fit your model. You can maybe influence how often they're going to buy from you. So you said they're 3 months. You might have some tactics to get them to buy every 2 months from you instead. And then the main one you can influence is obviously how much they're buying, how much they're spending with you at the time, because you can get them to buy more products. Or you can increase your price and get them to spend more by buying the same amount of products. So those 3 things combined are going to be your lifetime revenue, but that's not your lifetime value. And this is where so many people go wrong, because it costs you to make and sell or buy or whatever those products. So what we then have to do is, let's say £10,000 for that client over those 8 years, and then we multiply it by your gross profit margin. So your gross profit margin is the amount of money you make directly from producing or buying and then selling these products. So if you're at 50% margin, so every time you sell something for £100, it costs you £50 to deliver that. Then if you're making £10,000 over however many months or years, your margin is 50%. Actually, you're making £5,000 profit per client. And that is gold dust to know. Because then you can look at, like I said earlier, you can then look at the factors and say, okay, individually, if we have some tactics to get them to come back and buy from us just ever so slightly more, what will it do? Well, actually, when you multiply over all your clients, it has a huge impact. Mm. So these levers that you can pull, you only have to pull them a tiny bit, get tiny incremental things. You've got, other side, sorry, 1% better every day is exactly that. It's these 1% improvements can have a massive effect on your profit multiplied over. So for product-based businesses, it's all about understanding that. Then you can work on improving your margin as well. So if you can buy in the product or produce the product more efficiently, then obviously your margin is going to be higher, and so your profit per client over lifetime is going to be higher as well. Imagine you have that data at hand, right? How much easier is it going to be for you as an owner of a product-based business to then make better decisions?
Yeah.
It's so much easier. You're not completely guessing, are you? When someone goes, how much do you want to spend on marketing? You go, well, I kind of know how much I want to spend on marketing because I know how much I can get out of a customer, which then leads into the client acquisition cost stuff.
So then with client acquisition then, how do you work out? So that's probably how long is a piece of string, because it depends on your business. And so lifetime value is based on the value you're looking at is the profit rather than the actual total
revenue. The gross profit. And just for everyone's sake, I think it's really important, because it's a really misunderstood concept. So gross profit is your revenue minus your direct costs. So your direct costs are going to be the materials or the purchasing of the stuff you're reselling. Then you've got all your overheads. So your marketing, your sales, your accountancy fees, your legals, all that stuff. And then you have your net profit at the bottom. Mm-hmm. So whilst your overheads and your net profit is important, for working out how much you're willing to spend on marketing, you just need to work out how much you're going to make gross profit over a lifetime for every client you acquire. So then client acquisition costs. Yeah, the reason I laugh is, particularly in the product world, it is an absolute minefield. So let's talk simplistically, first of all, and high level, and then I can talk about some of the nuances around it. So at a high level, it's how much do you spend on marketing versus how many new clients did you acquire? So if you spent £10,000 on marketing this month and you acquired 10 new clients and your client acquisition cost is £1,000. When I presented this recently to somebody or to a workshop, there was about 40 people in the room, and I asked for a show of hands and I said, okay, we've got two businesses here. These guys over here are doing this type of marketing and they're acquiring a client at £1,000. And these people over here are doing this type of marketing and it's costing them £10,000 to acquire a client. Which business would you rather have? I didn't give them any other information, and every single person was really common. Oh, we want the £1,000 client acquisition cost. But my question to them afterwards, well, what if that business over there that's spending £1,000 to acquire a client is only making £2,000 back over a lifetime? That's not a great deal. What about this business over here that's spending a lot more on acquiring a client at £10,000, but they know over a lifetime they'll make £250,000? That's a great business. So the amount of money you're willing to spend on marketing and the cost to acquire a client is got to be relevant to the amount of profit you can make for them. And that's where businesses really struggle with this concept. If you know these numbers really well, it's like driving a car and putting your foot on the accelerator or the brake. Because if your ratios are right and you're comfortable and you're spending a small amount to make a large amount back and you want a bigger business and all the rest, then you go as quick as you bloody can.
Yeah.
So that's where investment is super powerful. Like particularly around that seed to Series A, if you can prove that you've got a good lifetime value per client and you've got a way to acquire those clients that's cost effective, then an investor will throw money at you, literally throw money at you, because all you've got to do is just ramp up what you're doing, do more of. If you're using Facebook ads or TikTok ads, go and stick a zero on the end of it and try and do 10 times as many and see whether you can maintain the margins. The problem is as you scale, particularly in marketing, you'll typically see a drop off of client acquisition costs because you exhaust certain areas or sort of certain marketing types or certain audiences that you're going after. And you'll see as businesses scale, the client acquisition costs will start to creep up. So at that point, you're like, okay, well, the ratio is not as good. So what do? I now need to ease off a little bit and then come up with some different ideas to improve that. Or I need to increase the lifetime value of a client to match it.
Are you ready to scale your e-commerce store? Want to do it without having to wear yet another hat and become a digital marketing expert? This episode is brought to you by Neon Digital Clicks, the paid traffic partner for family and women's e-commerce brands wanting to scale their stores from five-figure to six-figure months using Meta, Google, and Klaviyo marketing services. Neon is offering listeners a free scaling audit worth £3,000. So whether your sales have plateaued or you're looking for growth, this is a great opportunity to lift the lid on your business and identify where the opportunities are hiding. Head to scalingglow.com to discover just how much revenue you could scale your store to this year.
Yeah, and I think it also then back to that as well is you need to relook at what actual product suite you're offering, because if they've been a loyal customer for a very long time and you're not bringing out newness, they've possibly bought everything you've offered.
Yeah.
So if it's not a perishable thing or something that they need to rebuy, you need to give them some other newness or else they've got an end life because they've bought everything and you've not brought out anything new. So you've saturated that offer.
Right, exactly. And that's where that understanding your lifetime value really works. The example you gave was absolutely brilliant because in that example there where you sell kids clothes 0 to 5, you know what that is. And you can even make a conscious choice to try and change that or that you work within your constraints. So if you don't have any ambition to create other products beyond that age range, then you know that's always going to be your lifetime value. You might be able to increase your price, but your client acquisition cost has always got to be efficient compared to the fact that you know you're going to get the client for 8 years, whatever. I mean, 8 years is a very long time, but a lot of product businesses work on a much smaller smaller lifetime. But it's why you, like on Amazon, I keep making a mistake of instead of buying something once, sign up to the subscribe package, and then it turns up on the doorstep once every few weeks when I don't need it, because they're finding ways to get you to come back more and more and more often.
Yeah, absolutely. And how long does that investment process take?
Yeah, it can vary massively because you've got to go out and find the investor, and finding the investor, you might get lucky and find them really early on, but it could also take 6 months to find the right investor. Typically, the larger the amount of money you're asking for, the more sophisticated the investor, the longer the process will be. So like if you go right to the very beginning and you get a private equity investment, the due diligence phase on that, the bit where they dig deep and go, yeah, it sounds good, but tell me what you're actually doing, sort of go through all your numbers and stuff. Like that bit can take a while. whether it's friends and family, you might just reach out to someone and say, look, I've got this cool idea. Let me spend 10 minutes on Zoom with you and they might give you some money. So it does vary. But I always say, like, it'd be really surprising if from when you start the process of thinking about investment to getting that money, if it's anything less than 6 months, that's usually a very quick turnaround. So what you need to be doing when you're thinking about raising investment is factoring in sort of 6, maybe even as many as 12 months. Like if you're going to run out of money in 4 months and you decide you're now going to go and raise investment, you're going to be really tight time frame and you're going to end up either not finding investment and running out of money, or you're going to take an investment that's not right for you out of desperation.
Yeah, and get yourself screwed in a deal.
Yeah, exactly. Rubbish deal terms, or connecting with an investor that's not right for you, like the different values or a different end goal. They want to sell the business in 2 years. You want to keep it for 10. Like, it's a recipe for disaster.
Yeah. So we talk in terms of what the investors are looking for, that authenticity, that storytelling, that passion, the numbers, and absolutely the data side of things. In terms of how long it can take, early stages, a little bit less, but like you say, kind of aiming for 6 to 12 months. That initial reach out when you're reaching out to people that you don't know to try and get those first meetings, because you don't want to put war and peace in that.
No.
In that email, they don't need to know your life story, what you had for breakfast and all that kind of stuff. So I would imagine, do they need your pitch deck at that time? Or like what, that initial reach out, that very first reach out, what should you...
Yeah, so it depends on what they want to see and who you're going after. But some of them will ask you to send over the pitch deck straight away. But if not, just a really short mini, this is us kind of, maybe one slide, maybe two slides. Like you said, they have tons and tons of these come across their desk. You need to try and stand out. So it's whatever makes you stand out. And if you're in a more advanced business, then it might be your numbers might make you stand out. You might say, look, we've got, I don't want to keep going on about it too much, but if you've got a really strong client acquisition cost to gross to lifetime value, then show that off. Like say, look, we're acquiring clients £100, they spend £10,000 with us. Not everyone has that, because typically you won't have that data till you're a bit further on. So the early stage is about that story. What makes you different? What makes your product stand out? What makes you stand out? If you're really early stage, it's less about the product and more about you as an individual. So
what you've done in the past or your story. Yeah,
exactly. Like, and it's why these investments that have these stories behind them, real stories, but powerful stories, are so much easier to go and get investment. So if you have a life event that's happened to you and then it led you to create this product, like, that's a great story. Not everyone has that, but if you have it, make sure you leverage it.
Yeah, so that initial reach out, keep it sweet, but direct, bit of story, bit of feeling.
Yeah.
But, and like you say, some people might get asked for the pitch deck straight away. And what about working out your valuation of a business?
Not the answer that anyone wants to hear, but a business is worth, like anything, it's worth what anyone's willing to pay for it, which might sound a bit like a cop-out, but it just does vary so hugely. Let's start with the slightly bigger end. So let's say you're turning over $1 million already. If you're at that size or you're thinking about that size, then the valuation is a little bit more methodical, because what an investor will typically do simplistically in their own models, they might have far more complex ways of valuing a business, but the way that they'll communicate it will be a multiple of either revenue or adjusted EBITDA. Now, I said I wouldn't use many horrible terms, but just pointing out what adjusted EBITDA is, because investors will use it. So EBITDA is officially, it's earnings before interest, tax, depreciation and amortization. Horrible accounting terms. What it really means is, what's your profit before you pay any interest on any loans and before you depreciate any assets and that kind of stuff? So working out what that figure is and applying a multiple to it. And that multiple can vary hugely. So let's say you're making £100,000. Someone might give you a multiple of 3 to 4 times. So in other words, they'll value your business at £300,000 to £400,000. If you're really fast growth and you've got great numbers and you're in a market that's got a massive audience and all the rest of it, and you can prove that you've got some traction already, then they might value it 8 to 10 times. So 800 to a million. If you're not making a profit, then they might have to value you based on revenue. So what we see with some of these fast growth businesses is actually they make a loss or break even because they pump all their money back into marketing to grow quicker. And that's okay. That's their strategy. And if you manage it well, that's fine. So in those examples, then someone's going to give you a multiple of your turnover and say, we're going to base on the level of turnover you do, how quickly you're growing and how much potential we think there is to grow. So that might be 2 to 3 times your turnover, for example. So you might be making $1 million, someone might offer you 2 to 3 million. So that's the framework of how those valuations work. The valuer, the multiplier, it changes regularly depending on the market, it changes depending on the person buying, the stage, how quickly, and all that kind of stuff. I'll give you some rough ball points. I mean, low-end multiplier of profit to 10 is maximum, is kind of the range. That's quite a big range. Turnover might be anything from 1 to 3 times. So it kind of gives you that indication. If you're a smaller business and you're earlier stage, then that might not mean a lot. Yeah. So in those examples, it is far more just a discussion, and there's no real hard way of valuing a business. It's kind of, this is the amount that we need to get in as a starting point to do what we want to do. This is kind of what we think the business is worth, and therefore this is what you end up with. Does that appeal to you as the investor and you as the business owner? If it appeals to both of you, it might be okay.
And then there's more in terms of, well, the total market is worth this. The market in the UK is worth this amount of businesses that are turning over this amount. So then you're able to, hopefully, I would imagine, draw off other data to help build your case.
Yeah, particularly if you're a bit more advanced in terms of size and journey, then you can go and find other businesses in the same sector and say, look, this business sold for a multiple of 10 times turnover. This one sold at 12 times turnover. Therefore, we think we're valued in the same ballpark because we look the same. So if you can find those examples, then absolutely brilliant. You stick them in your slide deck and say, so, or you have them in your back pocket to base a valuation on, but you can put them in your slide deck to say, look, the end goal is we're going to sell out in 5 years. This is kind of the amount that we think we might be able to get. This is what other people have done in the same niche sector as us.
Going on to the slide deck and the pitch deck then, what should it include?
So like I said, it's all about storytelling. So it needs to stand out. You need to include the stuff about you and the team around you. That's really important. Like, concentrate on your strengths. If there are any gaps, address gaps. So like, when I work as a fractional CFO with clients, sometimes if I work really close with them, sometimes I'll be on a pitch deck because they'll show investors that, like, we don't have finance experience or whatever, but we've got Luke and he's an advisor. So it's important, if they're advisors, you point that out.
Yeah.
You don't want to mislead anyone. But if you have a skill gap as you, as the founder or founding team, then showing that you've got that support and you've identified it is really, really important as well. What's the problem that exists and proving that it exists in the market? And how does your solution solve that problem? A bit about market analysis. So what other competitors are there? The size of the market, the great points that you sort of talk about there. Size of the market in the UK. What does the market look like abroad? Because when you think about investment, it's the stages of investment in a product-based business are one of three typically that I see. So one is to get off the ground and launch the product or develop a new product and go into a new area. The second one is that things are working well and they're trying to do more of it. So that's that sort of scale-up thing. And then another one is, well, we've done well in the UK, but we think we can go and conquer Europe or US. That last one's a lot harder to prove, by the way, because everyone says, we've done well in the UK, we're going to go and conquer the US. It's obviously nowhere near as easy as everyone thinks. So investors are always a bit cautious about that. But that is a valid reason for going and raising. So you're talking about your plans. You just asked me some great questions there about your valuation, what you're trying to raise, what you're going to spend the money on, that kind of stuff. And then the bit I just touched on there, how is this investor going to get a return? So I spoke to somebody the other day about investment, the potential investment, and I was asking the question, once we got to the bottom of it, this entrepreneur had no intention of selling their business. They didn't want to exit it. They want to keep it for 15 to 20 years, which is absolutely fine. But when I pointed out that they're trying to raise investment and that investor will typically want like a 3 to 5 year return on that, how are they going to get that when you don't want to sell the business? They realize actually raising investment wasn't for them. So you need to make sure you're aligned at the end goal and talk about how your exit. So is it going to be a full exit, which is usually the case, which is 3 to 5 years. We want to be this size. We want to be at 10 million in turnover and we want to sell the business for 100 million. Like, then we'll be happy and we'll be rich.
And I suppose in that case, with your customer who wanted the business for 15 years,
yeah,
or however long, could they have gone along with the investment but said, right, in 3 years, we're going to get a different investor and they'll buy you out? So you start on that wheel of...
Yeah, so you can do that. It's just much harder. So if you want to do that, it's just absolutely vital. Like we touched on at the beginning about that alignment and making sure you don't get into bed with the wrong investor. Like if you're up front and say, look, this is what we want to do, and the investor comes on board and saying, yeah, that's okay, then that can work. So we got a client and we worked with a VC fund, and their gap was they invested between seed and series A. And this is what I said, no one fits nicely into these brackets that we talked about at the beginning. So their thing was, after seed, you proved yourself, we'll come in and we'll get you to Series A, and their expertise is to growing businesses and then helping them get that Series A investment. At that stage, they might well exit because the Series A investor might come in and swallow it all up and say, right, we'll buy you out. And they might say yes. Or in the case of my client, actually, they stayed on and they'll stay on longer. And that's okay because they think it's still a good investment for the next 3 to 5 years. So you can definitely do that. It's slightly less common and you just need to be on the same page. With all these things about investors, when you reach out to investors, you have to know what you want and you have to make sure it matches the type of investment that they make. Because all investors will want a different thing. So some of them will want much bigger returns. Some of them will be happy with smaller returns over a longer period or shorter period. Some of them want really high risk. Some of them want less risk. Some of them want massive gain. And you might be loss making, maybe that might be okay. Others want to see profitability. So you just have to match up what you want with the type of investor they are and their sort of investment theses, if you like, about how they give out money and what they expect to get back from it.
Because I have another question for you, but is there anything on that slide deck that you think needs to be added in?
Yeah, so SEIS, so talk about that because it's probably more relevant to people who listen to this. So it's the Seed Enterprise Investment Scheme. EIS is just Enterprise Investment Scheme, which is a similar concept, different numbers, and it's like the bigger sibling of SEIS. So SEIS is essentially, it's tax relief, very generous tax relief for investors that are investing in early stage risky startups. Because the government want to encourage that, but they also recognize it's incredibly risky investing in startups. Like you lose money 9 times out of 10 or whatever the stat is. So in order to do that, they'll give you tax incentives. So for the investor making the investment, they can get huge tax relief when they make the investment. They can get sort of 50% tax relief on the investment they make. It's very tax efficient when they go to sell the shares. So when the business exit or they sell their shares. If worst case happens and it fails, then they get some loss relief. So if you're investing like £100,000 under SEIS, your full exposure could potentially be something like 20 to 25% of that, because the rest of it you could get back in tax incentives if you when you make the investment and then if you lost the investment. So what that means is people are far more likely to invest and far more likely to part with more money than they would do otherwise. So you as a business, if you're appealing to those individuals, there's only individuals, VCs, private equity, the funds, they can't claim for the most part, can't claim SEIS. But if you're going after friends and family, high net worth angels, they will most likely want SEIS, particularly if they're experienced investors and they know about it, they're expect it. So you as the company need to be aware of that. You need to make sure you meet the criteria for it. And then you need to talk about how you're going to handle that process as well.
And that's government-backed scheme. Did you say?
Yeah.
Go to the gov.uk website and find out probably all about that. Is that where it's held?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. If you just Google SEIS, there's tons and tons and tons of resources. We partner with a company called Seed Legals. They got some really good resources for the company that's looking to raise investment and for the investor making the investment. It's something that we do a lot of. We do a lot of SEIS applications because of the sort of clients that we work with. So,
what questions should you ask an investor to make sure that they're aligned on that side of things? You know, to make sure the right fit for you. What can you ask them and what should you ask?
Yeah, ask them about their experience. I mean, they investors like any other job, because it is a job for them or passion, but you get a huge varying degree of sort of a spectrum of personality types. They tend to be fairly sort of sales focused, a lot of investors. So they'll tend to be quite forthcoming with what they've done successfully in the past. But if not, then always ask them that. Like you want to check that they've worked with other investors, other businesses of this size, what sort of returns they got, if you're expecting something from them other than money. If you're just expecting money, then realistically, all you need to do is just check that they're good for the money and they're going to follow through, that they've said they're going to. That's all above board, obviously, and that the exits align so that they want to exit 3 to 5 years. That's what you want. This is their expectation. That's what you want. If it's more than money you want, then there's a whole host of other stuff you have to go through. Be really clear about what you want from them. So if you want them to make connections for you, you need to find out about their connections. You need to ask how they can, who's the sort of people they can introduce you to? Are they willing to do it? Because just because they've got connections, they might make hundreds of SEIS investments and they might have no interest in sort of making those connections. If you've got an angel investor that's done 2 investments, he's going to be far more sort of brought in and far more engaged with you. But again, is that what you want? Because if you're in a solo founder for however long, and then suddenly you've got someone sort of chewing your ear and asking you questions all the time, like, is that what you want? So it's really important to set expectations, i.e. we will meet once a quarter and give you an update. you can't phone me once a week and say, how's sales going on? Unless that's what you want. Because there's investors that will do both and there's founders that want both. So really important to think about what you want. Whatever happens, investment can be a brilliant sort of milestone for the business and can really catapult you. But it can also be really bad and work out really poorly for you. So you really need to think about what that looks like and be prepared, because getting an investment-backed business, whatever that investment looks like, an investment-backed business is very, very different to one that you own 100%. You do, to a larger or a lesser extent, have someone else to answer to now, whereas you didn't before if you're a solo founder.
Any final words of advice?
Make sure you really want investment. Make sure it's really right for you. And make sure that you're confident that you can use it well. Because we've seen people go and raise investment and sort of waste it. Then you're giving away a chunk of your business and you haven't got what you want out of it. And make sure you align with your goals and their goals.
Amazing. Thank you so much. How can people work with you, Luke, and where can they find you?
Yeah, so best place is just go through the company website, so crispaccounts.co.uk. I'm on most of the social platforms as well. Check me out on LinkedIn or Instagram and message me. My DMs are always open. Very informal. Just reach out and we'll just have a chat. Just find out about you and your business and see if we might be able to help.
Thank you so much for joining me. I'll put those links in the show notes for people that are curious about investment and also curious about how Luke and his team can help. And I'll be back again next week with another great guest. Thank you so much, Luke.
Thank you.
Thank you for listening to this week's episode of Start, Scale, Succeed. If you've enjoyed today, I would love for you to leave a review and I will see you again next week. If you'd like to hear more from me, your host, Nicole Higgins, you can follow me on Instagram at The Buying Retail Coach. Check out my website, www.buyingretailcoach.com, or find me on LinkedIn. All the links are below in the show notes. And don't forget to subscribe to my newsletter, The Step, for lots of helpful tips and advice.